Well, hello, and I'm Alec Hogg, and with us is David Shapiro. David, isn't it funny? I mean, we go on to our noontime webinar, and so help me the hackers try and bring our site down. Anyway, we've got Cloudflare to bump them off, but it really is irritating that people think they can, I suppose, target you when you're supposedly at a weak point. But fortunately, we've got the best in the business to sort them out.
So you're all safe now. They're not
Yeah,
going
it's
to
a new
come in
world,
with.
though. It's a whole new world. In the old printing press, the only sabotage you had to worry about were perhaps somebody coming in and putting a spanner in the spokes of your printing press, or maybe pouring sand into the delivery vehicle engines. And today, we get a different. But anyway, thankfully we've been around a while, so we're well prepared for it. So the site, as it continues going forward, it just is. It is the way it is. But David, from your side, it's been, I don't know, did you listen to Cyril Ramaphosa last night?
No, not
Okay.
for no other reason than we had load shedding. So,
Really, what a joke. It's not a joke.
it's ironic that you get kicked out, and so anyway. I read the headlines. I mean, I know what's happening, and it's a kind of step backwards. I understand what they're doing, but there's still a lot of anger out there, and a lot of concern. Alec, my big concern is that as we go backwards, I think people get taken down another notch, and that's what's concerning, is that economies are driven by confidence, and that's what gets people to go out and spend and to do things and that. And yeah, we've been very patient and we understand the consequences and that. But when you go backwards, when you feel that you're making progress and then have to go backwards, I think it has a very, very negative consequence. And what we must understand as well, from I know the liquor side, it's rather unfortunate that we have people who get drunk and drive and diet and cause accidents and fill hospitals and so on. It's also an indictment on our law enforcement agencies and that, but it hurts. It hurts all the retailers. They're big into cigarettes and they're big into liquor as well, whether it's Spar, whether it's Checkers, no matter who it is, it's a big part and there are big margins there as well. So it's going to be felt in the retail industry as well, in that side of it.
David, I'm seeing some very uncomfortable parallels here with the 1930s in the United States, economy contracting, and then the politicians at that stage thought they could apply rules like prohibition, and all it did was give us Al Capone, gangsters, craziness that went on during that period until they were eventually forced to relent. And this prohibition, because it is, that's what it is. You announced at 8 o'clock at night that no more alcohol will be sold. It almost looks like a very, very blunt tool that is being applied without any engagement. We're going to have people from the liquor industry joining us a little later to give their thoughts. But from the statement that they issued today, there was no consultation. They were never told. They were never asked. They were never given any options of how they could help in preventing the excess or the increase in deaths, which come from the sale of alcohol. And that it looks like we just got a command council, old Soviet style, do it my way or else.
I think you've touched on a very sensitive point. We're perhaps topping the league there, but this is the biggest concern about lockdown overall. I think in the global economy, that governments are just taking it upon themselves. They've forgotten about the consultative process, the democratic process. They're just doing things of their own accord. And you even see it in financial sectors. Even here, Stephen Kosseff, bless his heart, and I'm not having an attack on him. He said, companies should just be allowed to issue shares. You say, hold on a sec. You can't, we know you're in trouble, but you still got to have some kind of process. You can't just override these kind of things and just issue shares. And it's the same way as here. You can't just close down business without some kind of consultation. You are going back to that and you're driving this underground. People will find liquor that kind of falls off the back of a truck, which is exactly what it did in the bootlegging days. And people who want to drink will drink. You know, they will find it. They're going to have people over or they're going to have a dinner. And it's the same as smoking. I haven't seen people, you know, dropping down dead from not having their smoke. So they obviously are getting it somewhere. So people are benefiting it. And I'm on your side in this respect. I think that, you know, this is not going the right way. And I think the processes, you're right, are not correct.
Only as an investor. You would be looking at the competence, or it's either brilliance or incompetence, or they're captured. It's got to be one of the three. It's either brilliance because they know something that we don't know, i.e. that they're going to be closing down all the cigarette or the illicit cigarettes and the illicit liquor industry, or it's incompetent. They don't know how to, and they're making stupid decisions. Or it's captured in that the government is actually against the state, as has been written time and time, time again. So you've got one of those three, and I think any rational person is going to ask the questions on those three. But how are the investment markets voting? What are they looking at?
That's where we're being misled. By being misled, you know, at the moment, the markets are doing pretty well here. But when you analyze them, it's not South Africa Inc. that is recovering. Yes, there's a lot of trading taking place in underlying shares, but overall, that side of the economy is under huge pressure. You know, there's been big, big sell-offs, even in banks. You know, there's been a recent recovery in banks, a recent recovery in one or two other shares. But overall, South Africa Inc. is under enormous pressure. If not for Prosus, if not for gold shares, if not for the mining shares, which are all things that are happening outside our border, the iron ore price, the copper price, the gold price. You know, we hardly mine. We mine 100 tons here. So we're hardly big miners. So that's keeping the JSE. Take that away, you've got a different picture that has emerged, you know, which is showing you very, very weak underlying businesses and that. So that's what you've got to look at to see how the business community are coping with it. And wait until the results start to come out, which we've already started to see in the form of trading statements. A lot of pressure here. And that's where taxes are collected. Taxes are collected from money that's made in South Africa. Not from Prosus, not from BHP or Anglo's, not from those mines. You know, you don't make that. That's collected in Brazil, you know, or wherever they operate. So understand that.
But where's the disconnect here? Because if you continue to play the game that's being played, in other words, we are all powerful politicians. We will decide what is good for you in South Africa. And I get that they've been elected, the politicians are elected, and they can, until they get chucked out of office, believe that. But there's a disconnect between what they're doing and the reality. How are they going to fund this, all of this? How are they going to pay the salaries at the end of the month? How are they going to continue to keep the wheels of the economy rolling, or the public sector, which is one third of the people employed in this country, who then get paid by those in the private sector? Where does that disconnect come, or are they gambling with us?
They're just hoping that something happens that gets them out of the poop, and it's not going to happen. In other words, you're right to be fearful. You know, you're right to bring up those things because they're not
fearful.
It doesn't balance. How are you going to save SAA? How are you going to save all these institutions? The only way you can do it, which is not going to happen because Tito won't allow it, or certainly Lesetho won't allow it, is to print money. You know, that's the only way you can start creating monopoly money, as happened in Zim, but they're not going to allow that. And God forbid that happens, because the rand will just tank. So we haven't got the money, and nor is there a plan or a coherent plan, to get this right. So you've got to, the money's here, Alec. The actual money is hidden. What you've got to do is create the confidence that people feel that they want to spend it, or they want to make the investment. And that's where the disconnect's coming. The government's saying, we know better. We know how to do this. Don't interfere. And business people are saying, just let us be part of it. Come and consult us. We'll do it. But you've got to get away from ideology, and you've got to get away from this almost authoritarian approach, and let us do what we are good at. You know, so I from my point of view, that's where the disconnect's coming is. You know, this, what are you, the developmental state? You know, we know what's good for you. We're not China. We haven't got 2,000 years of, you know, of culture behind us to do that. You know, so, that's where the worry is. And that's where the worry is actually available. In, you know, you see that in the kind of results that are coming out and in SA Inc. companies.
David, from the people that you deal with, your clients, you've got lots of wealthy clients, people who make huge contributions to this economy through their taxes. What are they feeling about what they see, the way that the government has been handling this whole lockdown?
I've been talking about it the whole morning. They're hugely concerned. And you always ask me where I invest. And I think the safe haven or the safety valve is, okay, we'll live here as expats, but we're going to protect our money by taking it offshore. And I think that's what we've seen happening here. You know, people are very nervous of investing in South Africa, and whatever money they have is being channeled offshore correctly. You know, it's a correct decision. They'll bring it back. If there's opportunities here, that money will come back. But at the moment, there's far better opportunities elsewhere than in South Africa. And that's the message we can't get it through. You know, we can't get that through. Create the environment. Put out a red carpet. You know, ease back on so many of the constraints and you know, inhibitions that you create in the market. Just forget about the ideology. Forget about politics. Let's get growth going. Let's get businesses up. But you can't make headway. And this is an example. You know, this is an example. But dare challenge them. You dare not challenge them.
You know. There's my question for you, David. Mm-hmm. Is this government incompetent, captured, or brilliant?
I wouldn't say the last. I think it's more incompetent and captured. And we don't know who the advisors are. We don't know what goes around, you know, in cabinet meetings and where these decisions are getting made. You know, the other point as well is that, yes, there are other opposition parties as well. Consult them, bring them in as well. You know, use them. That's democracy. Yeah, I know you're the leading party, but it doesn't mean that they marginalize. It does mean that there are other people with other views in the country. And in fact, I suppose the same thing applies in America as well. You know, you don't get all the views. And in America, you know, 50% of the people didn't vote for you, or more than 50%. Use them, speak to them as well. You know, represent the entire nation and use the brains, use whatever you can get within a nation. That's what I find just astonishing in this country as well, that we do have a history of good governance, and we do have a history of very competent business people, you know, who've pulled us out of a lot more, you know, very, very difficult times. Find them, use them, talk to them. Doesn't happen.
Interesting point that you make there. How many people voted for the ANC? What was the percentage? Was it at the last election?
Call it 60%. Was it less than that? 60? I don't know. And so it means that 40% didn't, yeah.
And you consider how many people didn't vote. So you don't really have a divine right to rule like an autocracy.
So that's my view, yeah. That's what I can't understand.
It's shared by people who can make a difference in this economy. Are people now getting angry and saying?
Oh, yeah. I think people are getting very, very angry now. And the wrong kind of people, the people who've got the money and have got the money to invest, you know, those are the ones that are getting very angry. And those are the ones you need. So, I think we are, you know, Tita understands, Lucinda understands, they know, you know, if you speak to them, they know exactly what needs to be done. But, I don't think it's shared right, you know, across the table or around the table.
David Shapiro, as always, calling us beta bloody shovel and doing a direct talk. Well, we had a wonderful webinar last week with the founders of First Brand, and in that, I asked Paul Harris what was his likely future, what was he looking for the future of South Africa. He said, you know what? We don't live in a zoo. Most countries are like zoos where people just go about things, they get fed, they get happy. He says, we live in a wilderness, and in a wilderness there are lots of opportunity, but sometimes it can be quite a wild place to be. Now, David, I think you've got an issue on your side, so we won't worry too much about it.
The doorbell's ringing and my wife's got pods in her ear and can't hear it.
Well, stay with us, David. Let's bring Nick Hudson in now. Nick Hudson is one of the people, I guess, hi Nick, who would agree with quite a lot of what you had to say a moment ago. Nick, just for background, it was an oblique reference, I would say, to you guys last night by the president, saying that you have these forecasters who are not really all with it. You've said continuously at Panda that you guys are looking at South Africa having about 10,000 mortalities in total. The president again last night said his modelers say it's somewhere between 40 and 50,000. You have also said to me that when the facts change, you will change your mind. Are you at the moment changing your mind?
No, absolutely not, Alec. We have stuck to that 10,000 number since our first correspondence with the NICD in April. And we don't see any reason to change it. You know, a fair summary of the situation is that the hypotheses of the modelers have been falsified by the emerging facts. And by that I mean by every single country's experience anywhere in the world, every time a country that's come out of lockdown hasn't had a resurgence, there have just been repeated instances of falsification of their hypotheses. And I mean, it's fair to say that faced with a choice between changing their hypotheses and abandoning reason, they've opted to abandon reason. And so our government is being misinformed.
Let's just pick up a couple of the comments that came out, or little segments that came out last night. I'm going to start with the curfew, because I'd like to get your insight into this. If you can just, let's just hear what the president had to say. It's about 45 seconds.
Most of these and other trauma occur at night. Therefore, as an additional measure to reduce the pressure on hospitals, a curfew will be put in place between the hours of 9 p.m. and 4 a.m. Apart from people who need to travel to and from work or who need to seek urgent medical or other assistance during this time, everyone will be required to remain at home. The curfew will take effect from tomorrow, Monday the 13th, 2020 at 9 p.m.
Okay, so we have a curfew. Has that proved successful anywhere in the world?
I think in order to assess success, you have to look at what it's trying to achieve. You know, there were curfews put in place in many regions. The short answer is it hasn't achieved success anywhere. NPRs have not been demonstrated to delay or flatten curves in any country in the world. That is an assertion or a view of the world that has just repeatedly been disproven. But let's look at this instance, Alec. I mean, it's almost comical, okay? What you've got is a handful of hospitals in Gauteng that are indeed full to the rafters, as they have been for most of the last two decades, okay? We built a facility at NASREC, provisioned it with thousands of beds for the purpose of dealing with overburdening that was anticipated under these enormously overwrought models. That facility was not equipped with oxygen. Only 8 beds are oxygenated, as I heard this weekend. So it more or less can't be used for these thousands of COVID patients that are anticipated.
Just say that again.
Only 8 beds in that facility were equipped with oxygen.
Okay, so is that incompetence captured or brilliance?
In combination of the first two, definitely both, I would say. But that's just my opinion. I think an alternative is very hard to see your way to. But in response to the situation with a couple of overburdened hospitals in Gauteng, we've gone and imposed a curfew on an entire economy. So in the Western Cape or in the Northern Cape, where there's not much happening at all, in the Western Cape we're in decline. We've passed our peak 3 weeks ago. We now have all of those businesses that were just getting going again, all the restaurant and services companies that will be affected by this, are now slammed back into complete disarray. And just bear in mind that in addition to this kind of absolute idiocy, they're already dealing with blackouts, stage two load shedding, and a period of a couple of months, 3 months, where they weren't able to earn any revenues at all. You know, there's been this rather facile notion that it's okay to shut these businesses down, it just affects the 1%. But it's precisely the other way around. The 1%ers are people like you and me and all the university professors who are shouting for lockdown, the public sector doctors who are shouting for lockdown, they're the 1%. The people who are affected by this are the workers and the entrepreneurs in this economy. Your middle to lower middle income people are going to bear the brunt of all of this. And, you know, our economic research shows that there's an enormous wave of business shutdowns coming in August and September. And it is an absolute fallacy to attribute those to coronavirus. Those are attributable to this crazy lockdown.
How heavy is our lockdown in South Africa compared with other parts of the world?
Ours is by quite some distance one of the most draconian lockdowns that has been recorded anywhere.
And you would argue that that's not justified given the data?
Yeah, when I say there's an absence of evidence in support of lockdown having any curve flattening consequences, I mean the word absolute in its full sense. We've gone out and asked people to provide statistical evidence of that claim. We've furnished our own statistical analysis that shows that there's no relationship between lockdown stringency and the number of deaths in a pandemic, or the number of days to the peak of that pandemic. So in other words, if you haven't got a correlation with both of those, actually, then you have a problem. If you haven't got a correlation with the duration to peak, then the curve flattening thesis fails. We haven't had a single response. The only response I get, Alec, it's almost comical, is, but Sweden, Finland, you know, look, Sweden, Finland. And it's a ridiculous cherry-picking exercise. I mean, if I include all the countries in the world, which is the right thing to do, such a relationship doesn't emerge. And the one thing we know about the vast differences between one country's experience and the next is that there are many, many factors at play. It's not just the story of lockdown. There are age differences, comorbidity prevalence differences. There are density issues at play, potentially, and, you know, all sorts of reasons why two countries might have different death rates. I mean, a very interesting one that emerged and was pointed out to us last week is the intensity of last year's flu season is a very strong predictor in an inverse kind of way. So if you had a severe flu season last year, you will have a light COVID epidemic. And if you had a weak flu season last year, you have a strong COVID epidemic. And that, for example, just happens to be very explanatory of the differences that are observed between the various Nordic countries. So there are all sorts of issues at play. And the fact that that's the only piece of evidence we ever get shown is just telling you how weak the science is in support of lockdown theory. And I mean, we mustn't forget that until 2019, the World Health Organization's official policy was that lockdowns didn't work.
Wow. Nick, some of the other points that were made last night, well, the biggest one, the one that's caused the most controversy, given that we know, certainly here at BizNews, we've had two cigarette smugglers come onto our podcast, tell us how they get the cigarettes into the country, explain wow. that the prices are now up by 500 or 600%, explain that when cigarettes are more expensive, people share them. So in other words, doing precisely the opposite to what the whole intention was, that people would not share cigarettes, that it's not banned. Of course, last night we had alcohol being banned or alcohol sales being banned. Again, from what is happening globally, what is the justification of that? I'm going to play in a moment when we get the liquor industry spokespeople on what the president said about that last night. But from a pure data perspective, is there a correlation between banning alcohol and lower COVID-19 deaths?
Oh, definitely not a correlation in that regard. I mean, I think the motivation is to try and ease the emergency wards of those overburdened hospitals. But again, the sense, if assuming that that was indeed the cause, which I'm happy to go with, then the sensible thing to do would be to ban alcohol sales in a 10-kilometer radius of those hospitals, not throughout the whole country. You know, and so you have to ask, okay, it's so obvious that that's the case. What's the alternative motive? And if you're telling me that I need to go to a conspiracy theory, that there's a capture story behind this, yeah, that's sounding like a sensible story right now, because the deep irrationality of what was done last night is hard not to see.
Well, we have enough experience from other countries in the world where alcohol sales have been banned, and the consequence has been just funding the illicit economy. It is strange that rational consequence is not believed. However, that there might be another thing, and that's just an incompetent decision or a decision taken as a collective, so nobody's really responsible.
Yeah, a combination of the two is probably where I would put my bets.
I'm going to play you something else, because this really had me confused last night. When the president spoke about taxis, he explained the following. So just listen carefully and see if you can get the logic in it.
Taxis undertaking long trips will have to adhere to a 70% occupancy, but those who are undertaking local trips will be permitted to increase their capacity to 100%.
Help me out here. Where's the logic?
Look, in this one, there is actually a thread of the plausible. Let me give it its most generous possible interpretation. It's not too stunning to sort of understand that there's a theory that says that viral load is what is a leading sort of indicator of how likely you are to become infected and also of disease course. Okay, so that's a plausible story. And so if you're sitting next to somebody who's infected for 10 minutes, that's different from sitting next to them for a 3-hour journey. Okay. So there is some shred of science that you could reach for to support that story. Funny enough, the one thing that masks do is make sure that your air projects sideways and not forwards, which would seem to be a little bit hard to understand in the context of sitting in a taxi. But let's drop the mask issue for now, because that's one area where I don't think you will ever get scientific support for wearing ordinary cloth masks. The experiments are just too difficult to arrange, and the non-healthcare consequences are also all too difficult to pin down. But yeah, I mean, that one has a little bit of method to it. But again, Alec, we're making the huge assumption here that asymptomatic cases are highly transmissive. You know, what you want to do for sure is make sure that sick people who are coughing and sneezing and sputtering, are not out and about in public. But, you know, an interesting thing happened 2 weeks ago. The chief scientist at the World Health Organization, I think her title is Director of Science, came out and said, look, as far as the World Health Organization is concerned, there's not a lot of science behind the idea that asymptomatic transmission actually takes place. Then, very, very, quite stunningly, on the same day, the World Health Organization, which had previously been of the opinion that wearing cloth masks did not help at all, okay, did an about face on the wearing of cloth masks. And we understand that emerged from the head office. Okay. Now just think about that. Those are completely contradictory pieces of information being released on the same day. I mean, the motivation, the supposed motivation for wearing cloth masks is that it reduces asymptomatic transmission. But here you have the head scientist coming out and saying there is no asymptomatic transmission. Now, in the face of that enormous contradiction, if we watched carefully, and a couple of hours later, I think it took 4 hours, the director of science's opinion on asymptomatic transmission was quietly withdrawn, and the mask-wearing story stuck. That is the level of absurdity that we're dealing with in this world at the moment, Alec. It cannot be made up.
There have been a lot of these examples. I know the DA is getting all excited about, in the Western Cape, about the president saying you can have inter-provincial or intra-provincial, so not outside the province, leisure bookings. And then 4 or 5 hours later, that was also retracted after being announced. We had cigarette sales, which were then released, and then that being retracted as well. So it's this kind of flip-flopping, which I guess does send a lack of confidence through to the general public. But just from your perspective, you guys at Panda have been banging this drum now for a long time. Even last night, the president said again that he's looking at his modelers. He believes his modelers, you say 40 to 50,000 deaths in South Africa by the end of the year. Are you still sticking to 10,000? And indeed, would there be any reason for you to change that forecast?
Yes. If the deaths suddenly deviated from the curves that we're using, and those are simply, you know, curves that have been observed to fit elsewhere in the world. We haven't got some, we've never been in the model building game. Okay. We're not here to try and, put a better model in place. We just use these curves to illustrate how out of whack the science of these models really is. And we've been, as you say, banging that drum very quietly since April, with a little bit more noise at the Dr. Pisa's modeling symposium in May. And since then, as we've been ignored, with continuing, with escalating volume in the press. And they haven't answered a single criticism. You know, it is manifestly clear that those models are out of whack. And it got reached an almost comic pitch 2 weeks ago at the Western Cape's modeling presentation where, you know, the numbers just carried on tracking our curve. The models rapidly exponentiating curves were now being, you know, leaving those numbers far behind. And the guys were scrambling to try and explain the differences. And it got quite sinister. They started using the all-cause mortality excess death to plug the gap, which they could only do if they actually assumed that because of lockdown, all-cause mortality would be lighter. So they jumped the curve down and then compared it to their line of the line of all-cause mortality and assumed that this inflated number of excess deaths was the reason for their modeling, their models not working. Okay. Now those are, it's just insane, Alec. It's completely gobsmackingly insane. And, you know, as I said earlier at the start of this, you know, faced with the choice between revising their hypotheses and abandoning reason, they've chosen to abandon reason. It's as simple as that. So to answer your question, if those numbers divert from our curve, then we adjust our, projection. And if it's a big enough jump, then we would seriously reconsider our hypotheses. And that's fair game. That's how science works. I wouldn't feel bad for a second if something, you know, there've been a number of things that we've called incorrectly, that none of them very consequential, but we just turn on a dime. If something that we guessed would be the case turns out to be wrong, we just change our minds. That's no big deal. That's how science should proceed. And if those models had done the same thing, when it started becoming obvious that their assumptions were wrong, and that the time it started becoming obvious as we're learning is actually February, if you want to be really fair, March. But, since then they've just done nothing. They stick with their guns. I mean, they've got this curve. The deaths don't arrive. So all they do is push the curve forward a little bit, expecting it to, you know, rather than asking themselves the question, what are we getting wrong? And that's really frustrating for us because we've pointed out to them in your pages, you know, look, that assumption that you've got there, it's not emerging in practice, you know. If you've said time and time again that if lockdown goes away, there'll be a resurgence of deaths. Well, 40 countries have now abandoned their lockdowns and there'd be no resurgence in deaths. what part of your hypothesis are you changing? Radio silence. And all we get back are ad hominem attacks. Never any logic, never any reasoning. Just name calling. There was a great example of it. Some sock puppet wrote an article on your pages today. Jay, somebody. You know, it's not a real person. That'll be one of the models tearing their hair out. I'm not even going to bother responding. It was such a deranged article. But, you know, that's the kind of thing we get. Just an ad hominem attack.
What has the reaction been like elsewhere, though? We do know that from government, from some epidemiologists, they're very critical of the voice that you are expressing. What is the elsewhere people that you've maybe engaged with, how are they responding to you?
There's been no engagement of any scientific nature. It's just name calling. So, I mean, yes, these guys are like politically vested in a certain view of the world. And as that view becomes harder and harder to sustain, all they respond with is noise. We've tapped into, you know, an epidemiological network internationally. We're in touch with epidemiologists who see the world the same way as we do. And there's some very big names in science on our side of the story. And that group will get bigger and bigger. They've been largely censored and silenced throughout this epidemic. I mean, you've had YouTube pulling down the videos made by acclaimed and, you know, decades of acclaimed epidemiologists with decades of experience, you know, saying, look, guys, we're getting this story wrong. Pull the video down because it contradicts the mantra, you know, the sort of this kind of woke cancel culture is infecting science. And you've got John Ioannidis, you've got Anders Tegnell, you've got John Giesecke, you've got Maskey, you've got Katz, David Katz. Yeah, I could rattle off 20 names if you gave me a few minutes of acclaimed epidemiologists who are all saying the same thing, acclaimed virologists, acclaimed immunologists. We are really in the grip of pseudoscience here, and it's a breathtaking affair. I mean, there are some seriously good memoirs that are going to be written in the next couple of years as the whole edifice of this lockdown panic porn phenomenon is laid bare, and the tragedy that ensues from the lockdown is counted.
Nick Hudson from Panda, thank you very much. It would be almost laughable if it wasn't so serious, in that decisions are being made on numbers.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Nick. Well, we're going to move on to a different topic now as we welcome Grant Back and Glenn Smith. They are with the South African Airways Pilots Association. Gents, if you can switch your video cameras and your microphones on. I can see Grant, your mic came on for a second. Glenn, there we go.
Getting there.
Okay, getting there. And then there we go. Grant, you should be with us. There you are. And Glenn, I think, there we go. Okay, well, good to see you, gents. Do I call you Captain, or can I call you by a first name? You guys, a little bit like our previous guest, Nick Hudson, have been vilified in the media by government or by the authorities, the regime, as Professor Michael Levitt, the only Nobel-winning scientist from South Africa, has described the authorities nowadays who are taking these decisions. But in your case, it's to do with South African Airways, your long-time employers who are trying to be rescued, and you are being perceived as the Pilots Association, and Grant is the chairman and Glenn is the chief negotiator, of putting an unnecessary spanner in the works. What's going on here, guys? You did come back to the business rescue practitioners with an alternative plan, which hasn't made it to the meeting of creditors tomorrow. Why are you being ignored?
I think it started off, we're used to it. What we went through with Julie Vianney, when she was obviously on the board, and I remember she getting up in Parliament saying the number one problem in the airline are the pilots. So we're used to getting attacked, and certainly our association been down that road before. When the business rescue started in early December, we felt that the problem, and we really tried to engage openly with the business rescue practitioners. We've been told to get the best out of a business rescue, that was always the best way to go. So we certainly engaged with Les Madison and Sidi Wadangwana. And as time went on, though, we realized that any type of consultation we had with the business risk practitioners was more of a box-ticking exercise, we felt, than anything else. Entered the DPE, and they certainly, through this LCF, which is a labor consultative forum, we believed that for once we were being heard, we were being now invited as labor to come together and work on a new plan for SAA, to turn it around and give our input on what we think would be the way forward in making SAA successful again. As things progressed, obviously getting five unions or six unions together, all agreeing and singing off the same hymn sheet is not an easy task. We felt that we did pretty well regarding previous engagements with other unions. However, about 3 weeks ago, there seemed to be a change in the perception and the interaction with the DPE. I think it was because ultimately we were questioning the data that we were getting from the DPE. They were getting their data from about five different plans that had been submitted from Alvarez, was one of the first group that were brought in. And then subsequent to that, Seabury were brought in. And all the data they were getting, they were analyzing and then formulating their own plan or perception. A lot of our concern was that there was very little aviation expertise within the DPE. And that was causing us to get rather frustrated because besides flying airplanes, we have a lot of skill within our ranks, tertiary educations, master's degrees, doctors, even within the pilot corps. And having been in the industry, both Glenn and I, for 25 plus years, we feel we had a lot of value that we could be adding, and we weren't being heard. And I think we...
Sorry, Grant, were you not brought into the conversation then? Because clearly the expertise, you got more than 600 pilots, you are highly qualified people, you know the industry, this is your whole life. Were you not engaged with?
We were engaged. What we felt was an open, transparent manner. However, that certainly seemed to change as we got more downstream or into the process with the DPE and with the LCF. And I think as we started to push back and make certain proposals, and the more we were ignored, we realized that this was probably going to be another box-ticking exercise to get labor on board. And we had been told that in order for the plan to be approved and for the financing, which still nobody knows where it's coming from, for the financing to be made available, all of labor had to be on board with what was being put in front of us. And we disagreed with what was being put in front of us. So I think that's the short answer. But I'd actually like to give Glenn an opportunity because Glenn has done an immense amount of work analyzing the data and also putting together alternative proposals on the way forward, which most importantly saves jobs, saves the fiscus going forward, and ultimately, from what we our perception, as it makes SAA have a better chance of actually turning around. So, Alec, if I can pass over to Glenn.
Of course. And Glenn, before you start, our liquor industry people have not come along. That's why I went a little longer than usual with Nick, and we've got right up until 1 p.m. So not to worry about a time constraint on that side. Glenn, over to you.
Thanks very much, Alec, and thanks for inviting us on. You mentioned earlier that we've been vilified. Yes, we've been called greedy and unreasonable, and seeking to self-enrich ourselves under the facade of trying to make a better plan. Your previous guest mentioned that when raising facts, when using data, the immediate response are ad hominem attacks. And we've seen that same formula repeated against us in a way that's heartening to know that it's not just us, that there's actually... There seems to be a concerted strategy that is how anybody who comes up with an alternative is approached. And as Grant mentioned, I mean, the last time we saw this this vitriolic narrative against the pilots was when we took on Dudu Mieni. Now, along with Outer, we approached government, we approached the courts and said that Dudu Mieni was putting the airline at risk, that that her and people around her and their actions were going to result in this airline facing tremendous financial strife. And here we are 5 years later in an airline that is absolutely crippled on its knees. And we have the ruling of an independent court that declared Dudu Mieni a delinquent director. In addition to that, 2 years ago, we approached the board of SAA, who were doing nothing about the actions of the CFO and CEO at the time, the acting CEO, Pumeza Nyatsi and Musa Zwani. And we made a Companies Act application to take on the powers of the board to have an investigation into them. We were threatened with libel. We were threatened with lawsuits. Instead, the new board was appointed. Beyond Johanna came on board. The allegations and the information that we put forward was investigated, and Pumeza Nyatsi and Musa Zwani were dismissed for, if I recall correctly, gross negligence. And yet here we are again, raising an alternative, wanting to speak with people, and instead of being engaged on the facts, instead of being engaged on the numbers, we're being vilified. So, you know, I think that anybody watching this, anybody reading the articles should be asking why. Why all of a sudden is there this almost rabid narrative being screened against the pilots and coming out again and again and again? And from our point of view, it can be because there has been no rebuttal of our alternative approach. Our alternative approach is one that deals with restructuring, it with empathy. It allows the airline to have flexibility. And I must say, I'm not in a huge hurry to criticize government here. What we are attempting to do at the moment with SAA would be incredibly difficult under normal circumstances. Then we're adding to that the fact that we're trying to do this under business rescue. And in addition, we're dealing with COVID-19. And no one has any idea what's going to happen going forward. And so the approach that we took was to say, how can you design a new airline going forward on a data-driven basis using some kind of benchmarking that also allows for flexibility? And instead of engaging with us on that model, as I say, we've just been called lots of names. So, I mean, Grant alluded to it earlier, but essentially this is a very simple problem, and we have asked the Department of Public Enterprise. They claim, you've probably seen in all the articles, that what we are proposing will cost more money and will cost the fiscus more and is not in the interests of the employees, the fiscus, or the creditors. But they've not produced anything to back that up. There's no data behind it. We've asked them to do it. We had a meeting with them last week, Monday. They said they would supply us with it. They haven't. We sent the same proposal to the business rescue practitioners. We had a meeting with them on Friday. They promised to provide us with a rebuttal of our alternative approach. To date, we have received nothing. Now, I'm not saying we're right. I'm not saying we have all the answers. But right now, there are some very simple questions that everybody can ask them themselves. There are two plans on the table, the one that is being put forward in the business rescue plan and our alternative approach. Now, does our proposal save more jobs? Absolutely. We start off with a total of 2,435 employees, and crucially, we do that in a way that comes in 155 million rand under the labor budget for this year, and it deals with a flexible approach to ramping up operations only when the traffic comes back. It includes a 20% pay cut for the pilots, which is something that we put on the table unasked. It sees a drop in average salaries because of senior people taking packages. And the way you achieve that is, of course, by offering better packages. Now, do the packages that we've put on the table, are they better for pilots than the current packages? Absolutely. But that's not for greed. That's not for us trying to enrich ourselves. That's because in order to reduce the costs of this airline, which has shrunk and shrunk, and with its shrinking, of course, you've ended up with a more and more senior workforce. So our average salary has risen because of that. So what we want to do is incentivize as many senior people to leave as possible. And you do that by offering the best packages. And the one thing that fascinates me in all of the reactions from government and others is we didn't look at this and say, we want a bigger slice of a bigger pie. That would be greedy. Instead, we said, what are the ultimate goals here? We should be, and it's crazy for me that as a union that represents 600 people, that we're the only ones who seem to be fighting for more jobs to be retained and for people to be looked after better and for people not to be thrown onto the street and for people not to be sent out into the worst unemployment crisis that this country has ever faced. And we're the ones who are fighting for this. So we're trying to get 3,099 people eventually, but right now we've come up with a way to save the fiscus 3.27 billion rand compared to the business rescue plan over 5 years. That's not, you would think that if you put that number on the table, that government would jump up and down and go, that's fantastic. You know, even if that's not the right number, if we can even get half of that, then we're off to the races. And instead the reaction was, you don't know what you're talking about. You're wrong. You're greedy. You're just trying to grab more. So let's talk about that quickly, if you don't mind. The DPE proposal seeks to pay 45% of the severance pay to pilots. Our proposal reduces that to 33%. And even better, we take a 2.2 billion rand pie and we reduce it to a 1.9 billion rand pie. We save the fiscus 290 million rand straight off the bat. Again, they're not interested. No one is interested. No one is talking.
Why, Glenn?
Can I answer that, Glenn? Can I answer? So Glenn makes this proposal and he's done an incredible job at a PowerPoint presentation. It was really easy to follow. You know, 1 + 1 = 2 and there it is. And that's what's going to save you. And I mean, and we had, 99% of the rest of the labor unions fully supporting, this proposal, by the way. And the one question they asked after this whole presentation and of course the 3.2 billion rand saving. And they said, well, what about your terms and conditions of employment? We need to talk about your terms and conditions of employment. That to them is the number one focus, no matter how much money we say we can potentially save. So it's a bugbear for them, and that's something that that they want, come hell or high water. It's been a bugbear for them for many, many, many years. And it's something that we have, well, because the way they perceive it, they've always been told from within management that it's the pilots' terms and conditions of employment which is creating the turmoil and why SAA can't make any money. Incidentally, SAA made money from 2008, 9, 10, 11, and 12 with the same agreement on the table. And in fact, Glenn gave me a great statistic here. He said, if the pilots had worked for just 50% of their salaries, so that Kate takes care of terms and conditions of employment, for the last 10 years, the airline still would have lost 20 billion. In fact, we have often said to government, we could have worked for free and you still would have lost money. So it's a convenient scapegoat. They like to point fingers. Pilots, their terms and conditions of employment, they see them as very onerous. And, I mean, in the words of the DG, he thinks that what we're earning, what was the word he used, Glenn? Perverse.
Perverse.
Yeah.
He says, Is it different to what you would be paid if you're working for other airlines?
Well, Glenn, great question, Alec. Yeah, thanks, Grant. Great question. I mean, so this loves to get thrown at us. Our salaries come from a 2009 agreement that the company loved so much that they paid us a signing bonus to sign. They were so keen to get us to sign that agreement that every pilot got a signing bonus for signing it. That agreement has benchmarked us over the last 10 years. 8 out of those 10 years has benchmarked us locally, and 2 of the last 10 years have had international benchmarkings. And in both of those, it's been found that we've been about 20 to 25% behind our international peers. And yet, despite being that far behind our international peers, we took an 8.5% increase in 2010 and a 6% increase in 2015. So we in fact have enjoyed lower increases than general staff in about 3 of the last 7 years. We use a very unique benchmarking system. We don't expect to earn in rand terms what other pilots are earning in dollars. And that's probably just as well, because we have pilots in Hong Kong who are earning 8, 10, 12 million rand a year. pilots in Australia who earn 7-8 million rand. The pilots in America earn 50 to 100% more than the South African Airways pilots. So once again, this narrative that we earn more than our international peers is completely untrue.
Why do you guys stay in, given that you are globally skilled and obviously so, that you could get pilot jobs pretty much anywhere in the world at much bigger and much more secure airlines, why do you stick around? Why do pilots stay at South African Airways?
Because the salaries are pretty good. We're not looking to earn 8, 10, 12 million rand, Eric. We feel that our current salaries are appropriate for our role as highly qualified professionals. We feel that they adequately reflect the great responsibility that we carry, and we feel that the remuneration is matched to what we should expect to earn in this country as highly qualified professionals. And that is the intent behind the benchmarking exercise. It takes all that data from around the world, and it says, what does a pilot in Germany earn compared to a professional in Germany? What does a pilot earn in America compared to a professional in America? And it makes that same comparison here. And then let's not forget, we're South Africans. We love this country. We love our company. We love flying for South African Airways. From the time I was 4 years old, that's all I ever wanted to do was not fly airplanes, was to fly a South African Airways airplane. And that's true for most pilots in SA. So we stay because we like it. We stay because we enjoy it. We stay because we're South African, for the same reason everybody else stays in this country.
And well said, Glenn. I mean, 100% spot on. You know, obviously balance between what works for you. Is it financially driven, or is it a balance between lifestyle and finances? We've lost 110 pilots, took contracts, and they did it for various reasons. And that was about, 2 years ago, where there was career advancement. I mean, South African Airways has reduced from 830 pilots down to 617 on the seniority list today, 530 that are actively working. And that's sadly due to, you know, our state of affairs within the company. We're constantly trying to shrink to profitability, which anyone in the airline industry knows never works. So a lot of people have, through frustration, because of course it takes a long time to become a captain in the airline. At the moment, it's about 18 to 20 years, if not more, because it's all based on seniority and how fast the company's growing. But an interesting point, and if I could just, before we finish off here, Alec, at SAA Grow, at just 5% per annum for the 10 years from 2010 to date, every pilot that was in South African Airways, there were 830 pilots at the time, would be a captain today. But what have we done? We've shrunk continually. Our pilots have gone and flown for other airlines because they can get to be a captain sooner. And they've given up the lifestyle of living in South Africa to go live in the Middle East. And, you know, sadly, that's just indicative of this shrinking company that is not giving a lot of the junior guys opportunities to further their careers.
And I think, Alex, if I could just then offer one word in closing. I think it's, you know, here we are, we're sitting talking about the pilot's proposals, the pilot's salaries. What we're not talking about is the fact that we have a state-owned enterprise that has been mismanaged into the state that it's in and is now contemplating dismissing 80% of its staff. And that is a jobs bloodbath. And they are trying to do that via a voluntary severance package so that no one can come back afterwards and claim that that this was the result of any action by anyone in power. And I think, you know, right or wrong, that's our theory. I'm not saying it's correct or not, but it's just, I think anybody who reads anything about SAA right now needs to ask, why is the narrative being turned the way it is right now? And as Grant says, without our agreement, this airline would have lost billions for years.
Well, your court judgment that you went against Dudu Mnyeni and took 5 years to do it, is something which, in fact, the government should have done rather than a private sector, explains everything. And anybody, I would urge anyone who actually wants to understand the SAA story to go and read that judgment. You had many opportunities to for the airline to be highly profitable, and Dudu Mnyeni and her political overlords decided not to allow that to happen, or in fact actively sabotaged it. So it is strange, and maybe as a final comment here, so often we're seeing this happen where you take SARS as an example. You had captured individuals going into SARS, messing up the place, firing the good people or the people who were wanting to make a contribution, getting them out of the system. And finally, after a significant bloodbath, they're now not invited, back in to fix the place. And I guess from your perspective, that would be the question that I have to you. If you have experts in a particular sector, in a particular industry, why is it that South African Airways pilots are not being made part of the solution? Is it a industry-wide thing? Does it happen elsewhere in the world? Are pilots not promoted into management in other airlines elsewhere? Are they kept separate? It's just so the rest of us can understand how this sector works.
Well, I was at a conference in New Zealand about 2 years ago because we participated in the Association of Star Alliance Pilots, and we meet at various destinations, and they happened to be hosting it in New Zealand. Air New Zealand was in a terrible condition about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and they've become one of the top five airlines in the world. In fact, every time we'd meet, we'd always hear how successful they are. And when we gave our report back, we'd kind of have to look at our feet and shuffle and just say, you know, another loss followed by, you know, further losses and as our airline contracted. But as far as the involvement of labor, one of the key takeaways that I've had from those conferences is that if you look at all the successful companies out there in airlines, and it's probably across the board, the relationship between management and labor is essential, and it needs to be harmonious, and there needs to be respect, and there needs to be bringing in of the experts, and whether that's from the labor force or outside, so be it. But I mean, systematically, the pilots have been pushed out for the last, I would say, 8 years. From top management positions. When Dudi Mieni came in, anyone who put their head above the parapet, removed. As far as the pilots are concerned, I mean, we had our ex-acting CEO who left and jumped ship, I think it was in March, just before the lockdown. She's now the CEO of some other aviation entity in South Africa. She has systematically created a structure which disempowered the pilots from the day she took her position as the head of flight operations. We have brought this to the attention of the board. We brought this to the attention of the DPE, and it's continued to date, where the pilots have been disempowered as a constant mindset from everyone that was appointed, whether it was through Dudi Mieni, and even after her departure, her legacy continued on. Very sad to see. We've tried to get involved and add our expertise, even with Vianney Girana when he was the CEO, and I think he was very actively participated in engaging with us. But the narrative remained, and there's the structure that remained in SAA, which was anti-pilot, anti-pilot, anti-pilot. And it continues today. And to answer your other question, are pilots actively involved in management positions? Look at Lufthansa, look at the American carriers, look at Air New Zealand. A vast majority of their management have come from the pilot ranks. Glenn?
Yeah, no, I've got nothing to add there, Grant, 100%.
So what happens with you guys? You've got a meeting tomorrow with the creditors. How are you going to play it?
We've been made out that we, you know, if we don't toe the line, then liquidation is going to be the only option that government has. From our perspective, we certainly don't want to even consider liquidation. We believe SAA does have an opportunity to fill an aviation market in South Africa. And I know a lot of people are probably very tired about it. A lot of the listeners are going, why do we need SAA? And I think, you know, COVID-19 has changed a lot of things. I think your country needs an aviation sector. So I think it's a perfect opportunity to develop that sector. But, of course, we need the skills and the expertise to be brought in urgently, you know, to make that a reality. So that's not going to happen through liquidation. Obviously, looking after our members in the best way that we can wouldn't be done through liquidation. So at the end, what are we trying to do? We're trying to make sure we can get the best exit strategy for our members, save as many jobs as we can, and try and save the fiscus at the same time. As Glenn, or I call it Glenn's plan, because I know he did like 80% of the work on it, does it achieve that? Absolutely. So when the vote happens tomorrow, we hope that the plan will be passed, and that we can work with whoever is appointed, thereafter. And I think it's important to say that part of the plan and the DPE, and to their credit, have committed to the right board been appointed. And I don't know if you realize this at the moment, Alec, but I think there's only one person remaining on the board or two. There were some resignations last week. And to be have a fit for purpose management team appointed at SAA. We haven't seen any names. We haven't seen any movement. You would have thought, you know, Biani Girona stepped down in June or July last year. You would have thought that they would have actively been seeking a replacement. The replacement we got was far from ideal, but she's no longer with the company. And we told the minister, we said, surely, had you made appointments now, even in an interim measure, and we brought people to the table with the aviation expertise that have turned companies around, make those appointments, even if it's for a short period of time. Show the creditors that you're serious about making appointments. Show the South African public that you're serious about making the correct appointments. To date, nothing. So we have to trust that it's going to happen, and certainly hope that we are part of the new future at SAA.
Yeah, thanks, Grant. I think, Alec, you know, our approach is that we'd like to see as many jobs preserved as possible in SAA. We'd like to see this company thrive and grow, we hope that the plan does pass tomorrow, even though there are aspects of it with which we cannot agree. There are, especially as they relate to employees. And so we're taking advice and considering our position on how we're going to vote tomorrow. But the key takeaway for us is we have made a number of proposals that we think have merit, have data behind them, and save money. And so we will continue to take these proposals forward into the new relaunched SAA. We are very hopeful that the new management that DP have committed to will come on board quickly, and we'll then take these same proposals to them. And hopefully once we're talking to aviation experts, hopefully once we're talking to people that don't have the amount of baggage involved that currently, I think SA is paying a lot of overweight baggage charges when it comes to talking at the moment, unfortunately. So hopefully once we manage to cut out that, from our side, we're fully committed. We have committed to the DPE that we will renegotiate terms and conditions. We, even though we don't think it's the cause of where we are today, we will negotiate a new agreement that replaces the old one. The world has changed. We accept that. We acknowledge that. All we want is a fair shake. We want the employees who remain to be looked after as well as they possibly be, and we want everybody. And this is the biggest point that has been missed in our proposal. Our proposal pays a better severance package to every single employee, because to put people on the street in this current environment is bad enough, but to put an airline employee onto the street right now is tantamount to throwing them out of the aircraft without a parachute. There simply are no jobs in the aviation industry right now. And in order to look after people fairly, in order to look after people humanely and with empathy, you need to be putting people out there with the ability to survive anything between 12 months and 24 months. Otherwise, you're basically signing people to a financial death sentence.
And Glenn, your plan does that without any further cost to the fiscus. And I think it's an important point. Thanks, Alec.
Grant Beck is the chairman of the South African Airways Pilots Association, Glenn Smith, the chief negotiator, and then you had some insight ahead of the big meeting tomorrow that they will be having with the creditors. Indeed, the pilots themselves are creditors, so they'll be going into that meeting as, I suppose, equal partners to a degree, excepting that the banks have got a much bigger vote than they have got. But good talking with you. We dug around a lot today. I know South Africa... you might think that from time to time we get a little bit hot under the collar. Not the point. That's not the way to work it. We are trying to find solutions for our fantastic country. And by asking the difficult questions, by digging a little deeper, by looking at things that perhaps most people miss because they don't have the time or the inclination to reflect on so much of what's being imposed on our nation right now, we hope that we will be helping to provide a solution rather than adding to the problems. I'm Alec Hogg. I look forward to being back with you with Rational Radio on Monday at noontime. Just a quick reminder that on Thursday, we've got the Investec founders, Ian and Bernard Cantor, and Stephen Kossoff. They'll be in our noontime Thursday webinar. You can sign up for that on the BizNews site. And of course, we send out regular reminders through the Daily Insider. Thanks again for being with us. My colleague Stuart Lohman is still on the sidelines. Stu, can you just tell us where the recordings of the podcast will be? The webinar.
Thanks, Alec, and thanks to you and the guests for plenty of food for thought. As I said, it's a good time for listening in these times, which is great. Just on the chat bar there on the right-hand side, to all those still on the webinar, there's a little link to the YouTube channel. If you click on that, you'll be able to revisit all our webinars. And on the premium page, on the homepage, on the website itself, there's a little Google Calendar where you can actually get access to all the webinars we host as BizNews. But that's it from me, and have a great day.
Thank you. Cheerio.